Thank you very much, Dirk, for the invitation to speak at the UWA's Blockchain and Cryptocurrency Conference. Strictly speaking, I'm not going to be speaking today about blockchains or cryptocurrencies. But the issue that I'm going to cover, which is central bank digital currency, is very much related to the topic of the conference. Technological developments such as the emergence of distributed ledger technology, DLT, blockchain and cryptocurrencies, plus the ongoing digitalization of the economy and the declining use of cash, are prompting interest in the possibility of central banks issuing a new form of digital cash, a new digital form of cash, known as central bank digital currency, or CBDC. So many central banks are exploring the case for CBDC and considering the various policy and technical issues it would raise. So today I'm going to talk about some of the issues in this area, summarizing a recent article on CBDC in the Reserve Bank's September bulletin. I'm going to focus on the payments aspects of a CBDC rather than the issues for the broader financial system, but we can touch on that in the discussion afterwards if you like. So to foreshadow the conclusions, the Reserve Bank's view is that the public policy case for issuing a general purpose or retail CBDC in Australia is still to be made. Even though the use of cash for transactions is declining, cash is still widely available and accepted as a means of payment. In addition, Australian households and businesses are well served by a modern, efficient, and resilient payment system. And our payment system has undergone significant innovation in recent years, including the introduction of the new payments platform, which allows real-time, 24/7, and data-rich payments. However, the bank has got a mandate to promote competition and efficiency in the payment system and to contribute to the financial stability of the stability of the financial system. So we'll be continuing to consider the case for a CBDC, how one might be designed, the potential benefits and policy implications, and the conditions in which significant demand could emerge. But first, I'm going to give you a quick roadmap of what I'm going to cover today. So I'm going to start by talking about exactly what we mean by a central bank digital currency and how it relates to other forms of other payment methods in the economy. Then I'm going to move on to how a retail or general purpose CBDC might be designed, covering issues such as the role of the central bank in the private sector, whether the CBDC would be account-based or token-based. I'll touch on decisions regarding how it would be used in person, online, or offline. Would it use blockchain or distributed ledger technology? What degrees of anonymity or privacy would apply and who could hold the CBDC? And would it bear interest? Then I'm going to move on to some of the possible rationales for a CBDC and what problems they might solve. I'll talk about the rationales that have been mentioned in foreign jurisdictions. Some rationales that apply in countries that are experiencing a decline in the use of cash. And then I'm going to talk about some of the rationales that related to the growth of possible growth of new payment methods such as stable coins. And then I'll wrap up. So let me start by talking about what is meant by a central bank digital currency. Today in Australia, money exists in both physical or electronic or digital forms. Physical money or currency or cash consists of banknotes and coins. Banknotes are issued by and they're a liability of the Reserve Bank, so they can be called central bank money. So here's a diagram that might be helpful in thinking about the different forms of money. Now the first point to make in any discussion about a possible new form of electronic or digital money is that most money in Australia already exists in digital form. For example, currency represents only about 7% of the M1 measure of money and just 3.8% of broad money. The bulk of the digital money in the economy is in the form of deposits at commercial banks and other authorised deposit-taking institutions, or ADIs as we call them. These deposits are a liability of those ADIs, not the Reserve Bank. However, they are subject to depositor preference, and they're covered up to $250,000 per account holder by the government's financial claims scheme. We can refer to these deposits as being central bank money. Now, the Reserve Bank also issues digital money in the form of balances in exchange settlements accounts, or ESAs, that banks and a few other types of entities can hold. Currently, however, individuals don't have direct access to central bank digital money. If they want to hold central bank money, that is a form of money that's issued directly by the Reserve Bank, individuals need to hold banknotes. Now, when we talk about CBDC, we're referring to a new form of digital money issued by the central bank that would be more widely accessible than ESA balances. And we can distinguish between two types of CBDC. A retail or general purpose CBDC would be like a digital version of cash that is universally accessible. And wholesale CBDC would be accessible only to a more limited range of participants. And the focus of my talk today is going to be on retail CBDC, which could be considered a digital alternative to cash that could be a widely accepted medium of exchange and a store of value. But I'll be happy to talk about wholesale CBDC in a Q&A afterwards. I'm now going to switch off the slides. So what would a CBDC be? Like cash and central bank deposits, the unit of account of the CBDC would be the sovereign currency, i.e. the Australian dollar, and the CBDC would be convertible at par, that is one for one with other forms of money. Now, before I discuss some possible design elements of a CBDC, it might be useful to distinguish a retail CBDC from three other types of digital payment methods or types of private money. First is e-money, which is also known as stored value. This includes a wide variety of facilities, including prepaid cards and digital wallets like PayPal. In China, it would also include the widely used Alipay and WeChat Pay mobile services. E-money facilities are similar in some ways to bank deposits, though they're issued by non-banks and they're covered by a different regulatory framework than banks. Now, the user interface and the technology employed for a CBDC could be similar to that for e-money, but a key difference is that e-money is not issued by a central bank, so it presents some credit risk to the user. So the second type is cryptocurrencies or crypto assets, and these have their own currency unit, and they're not denominated in the currency of any sovereign issuer. Most cryptocurrencies utilize DLT and cryptography, and they don't rely on a central party to operate the system. Now, a CBDC could also be designed to use DLT, but a key difference is that cryptocurrencies are not issued by a central bank. Indeed, they aren't actually issued by any entity, and users are effectively relying on the software protocol that controls the system. Now, while the term cryptocurrency might suggest that they're a form of money, consensus is that existing cryptocurrencies don't provide the key attributes of money. They're rarely used or accepted as means of payment. They're not commonly used as a unit of account, and their prices can be quite volatile, so they're a poor store of value. And the third type of private money I'll refer to briefly are so-called stable coins. These have emerged in recent years as a type of cryptocurrency that is designed to minimize price volatility against some unit of account, such as the US dollar, or some store of value, such as gold, to make them more attractive as a payment method. One way their promoters attempt to maintain a stable value is by holding assets that back the coins on issue. For example, the Libra Association Consortium, which includes Facebook, plans to issue stable coins that would be fully backed by high quality assets. However, it remains to be seen if it remains regulatory approval and becomes operational. So let me turn now to how a retail CBDC might be designed. because most central banks are only in the early stages of considering issuing retail CBDCs, the precise attributes of a possible CBDC are very much still to be determined. There'd be many decisions to be made depending on the intended purpose of the CBDC and the underlying technologies that were being used to implement it. But it might be useful to talk about some of the possible choices here before I turn it to the question of what problems a CBDC might solve. A first key question in the design of a CBDC would be the roles of the central bank and the private sector in providing households with access to the CBDC. A one-tier CBDC system would be one where the central bank was responsible for all aspects, including issuance, account keeping, transaction verification, and so on. Alternatively, in a two-tier or a platform system, the central bank would issue the CBDC through private sector entities, and those entities would then manage all the customer-facing activities. I think there's a strong presumption that any issuance of CBDC in a market economy like Australia would be via a two-tier system. There's a wide range of customer-facing activities where central banks are unlikely to have a comparative advantage, especially in an environment where technology will be changing rapidly. Instead, it's likely that private sector payment service providers, like banks or fintech firms, would provide these services. Services like distribution to households, account keeping, customer verification such as KYC and AML-CTF checks, transaction verification, provisioning of mobile devices, and so on. These firms would also provide their customers with the ability to transact in and out of CBDC using existing payment systems. So a key point to make, and one that's relevant for many of the points that I'm going to make today, is that there would most likely be a very significant role for the private sector in any retail CBDC. So there'd also have to be some incentive for firms to participate. We can only speculate here, but the business model for these service providers could potentially involve charging account keeping fees or transaction fees. Or they might provide CBDC services for free together with other paid financial services or in return for using customers' data. Now, a retail CBDC could be structured as an account-based system or a token-based system or some combination of the two. An account-based system would have a record of balances and transactions of all holders of the CBDC. Transactions would involve transferring CBDC balances from one account to another after verification that the payer had the authority to use the account and had a sufficient balance in their account. By contrast, a token-based CBDC system would involve a type of digital token representing a claim on the central bank. Tokens could function as the digital equivalent of a banknote. It could be transferred electronically from one holder to another. Like banknotes, tokens would be bearer instruments. Whoever holds the token at a given point in time would be presumed to own them, rather than there being a record of account balances. CBDC tokens could be stored on devices, such as mobile phones or some kind of chip-based card, and then they'd move from one device to another when there was a transaction. A token-based CBDC could allow payments to occur without the involvement of a central party, which might be an advantage in an offline environment where there's no connection to payment service providers. But rather than a pure token-based or an account-based system, a hybrid system would also be possible. This could involve both device-to-token transfers between users and also some ongoing or periodic communication between devices and the central system. So this could allow a record of transactions and balances corresponding to those devices. It would also enable detection of any counterfeiting of tokens, potentially also the restoration of value if an individual lost their device. And it would also permit some degree of traceability of CBDC by the relevant authorities. So another question is how a CBDC might be used. If a retail CBDC was being designed as a replacement for physical cash, then at a minimum, it would need to facilitate in-person payments, for example, between two individuals or from an individual to a merchant in the retail environment. And being an electronic system, a CBDC would presumably be designed so that it could be used to make remote or online payments. In that way, it would function in much the same way as credit and debit cards currently do. As an electronic payment system, CBDC might be constrained by the ability by the availability of electricity in telco systems, in contrast to physical cash, which is sort of always on for exchanging between holders. However, as I just noted, it might be possible to design a CBDC system that could be used in an offline mode, which would be useful in remote locations and could offer resilience benefits when the power and telco networks were down. So I'll turn now to a question of particular relevance for this conference, and that is, would a CBDC use blockchain or distributed ledger technology? So while Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are based on DLT, this wouldn't necessarily be the case for a CBDC. The use of DLT could potentially provide benefits in terms of enhanced resilience and availability, although the overall benefits of decentralization might not be all that large. In particular, currently in the retail context, when existing payment systems are unavailable, it's usually related to problems at an individual service provider or to localized network or power interruptions, as opposed to an interruption to the centralized infrastructure, which is generally built to be highly resilient. In addition, it has to be pointed out that the use of DLT or current generations of TLT could have a negative effect on aspects such as performance, privacy, and security. You'll all be aware of the performance issues of public blockchains such as Bitcoin that result from their proof of work consensus mechanisms. So I think it's unlikely there'd be any serious consideration of public blockchain platforms for a CBDC. Instead, any DLT system that was considered for a CBDC would likely be permissioned, with access limited to payment service providers or other regulated entities. And it would need to have a consensus mechanism that could achieve immediate, final, and irrevocable settlement. Clearly, the degree of privacy or anonymity would be a key design decision for any CBDC. No doubt there'd be significant debate on this issue. However, given the potential for an anonymous digital currency to facilitate shadow economy activity and illegal transactions, many central banks have already indicated that it's highly unlikely that any CBDC would be designed to fully match the anonymity and the privacy that's currently available with physical cash. A related issue here is the question of who would be allowed to hold the CBDC and how much they could hold. Unlike physical cash, where it's not feasible to control who can hold it and how much they can hold, it would be possible to control these with a CBDC. For example, in an account-based model, users would presumably be required to verify their identity with their service provider before opening an account, just as currently occurs with deposit accounts at banks. In addition, while a retail CBDC would presumably be designed to allow universal access, there could be arguments for imposing limits on holdings if introducing a CBDC raised concerns about possible effects on financial stability or the structure of the financial system. And a final design attribute that I'll touch on is whether a CBDC would be interest bearing. While cash earns a zero rate of interest, a CBDC could earn a rate of interest, and the rate might be adjusted over time. Decisions here would presumably depend on the purpose of the CBDC and the technologies involved. However, most discussions around CBDC envisage that it would be primarily a method of payment similar to cash, with the presumption that it would not bear interest. So let me turn now to the question of why a general purpose CBDC might be introduced and what payments problems a CBDC might solve. I'm going to divide the potential rationales for CBDC issuance into three groups. First, the rationales that appear to be relevant to some central banks that are most advanced in pilots or prototypes of CBDCs. A few small countries appear to have taken decisions to explore or to adopt retail CBDCs to improve financial inclusion. These are countries, the Bahamas might be an example, where there is still very heavy use of cash and a significant proportion of the population do not have bank accounts and access to digital payments. In these cases, The introduction of a CBDC can be thought of as helping to fill gaps that the private sector has not been able to meet. Of course, examples like these aren't relevant to Australia, where almost all households have transaction accounts, including debit cards that allow both point of sale transactions and online purchases. And following the launch of the new payments platform in 2018, most households have the ability to make online, real-time, account-to-account transfers where the funds are available to the recipient within just a couple of seconds. Now, China is a different case. Its digital currency / electronic payment project is reportedly very well advanced. It involves a two-tier model where the CBDC would be issued by the People's Bank of China and then distributed by commercial banks or other service providers. One important rationale for their CBDC may be to provide a larger role for central bank money as an alternative to the very successful e-money services of the large private sector wallet providers. The second group of rationales for CBDC issuance are all related to the ongoing declining use of cash. Now, in the event that there was a significant reduction in the ability to make cash deposit and withdrawals, those households that are heavy users of cash might face challenges in making payments if they are not willing or able to transition away from cash. So it's been suggested that a retail CBDC that was accessed by a simple device with a well-designed user experience could potentially meet the payment needs for people who still rely on cash. However, this is still to be established. And if it does prove possible to provide easy access to payments using a CBDC, it would presumably be equally possible for a similar user experience to be applied to payment services using commercial bank money or e-money. Because as I noted earlier, the user experience for a CBDC would presumably be largely designed and provided by private sector entities. Another possible rationale for CBDC is to improve the resilience of the payment system, given that cash is currently a backup payment method for in-person payments when electronic payment systems are down. However, for a CBDC to provide a significant improvement in resilience for the payment system as a whole, payment services based on a CBDC would have to be provided to end users via different platforms and technology to those that are currently used by banks and other providers. And to be fully resilient, a CBDC would also need to operate, at least temporarily, without functioning electricity and telco networks. But as I discussed earlier, this could be feasible for some CBDC models. Another suggested rationale for CBDC is that as cash use declines, there could be decreasing competition in the payment services market and growing market power for large banks, for international payment schemes, and possibly also technology companies. Decreased competition could result in higher prices for payment services, possibly also in reduced innovation and poorer services. It's argued that the CBDC could provide a competition in the payments market that might mitigate the dominance of large private providers. Of course, as in many other industries, regulation may be an alternative to public sector provision of goods and services to deal with competition or resilience or accessibility concerns in payments. The Reserve Bank has a mandate and regulatory powers to promote competition and efficiency and to control risk in the payment system. The bank has used these regulatory powers in the past to address policy concerns in the card payments market. So to the extent that the decline of cash heightens concerns about competition or risk in the payment system, the use of regulation may be an alternative to the introduction of a CBDC. A final rationale that relates to the declining role of cash is that for a century or more, central banks in most countries have provided a safe, default-free, and free-to-use form of money for households to use. If cash was no longer widely available, some argue that central banks should provide a new form of central bank money so that households have an alternative to commercial bank or private money, which is subject to default risk. I think there are reasonable arguments for and against as to whether this factor builds a strong case for the issuance of a CBDC. However, the fact is that households are increasingly moving away from using central bank money or cash in their day-to-day transactions. And this may indicate that most households in normal times don't feel that strongly about any possible increase in risk from holding commercial bank money. If so, this may reflect a perception that depositor preference and the financial claims scheme or equivalent arrangements in other countries provide adequate protections for commercial bank money. So the third group of rationales for CBDC issuance are related to the emergence of alternative payment methods, especially including stablecoins. The emergence of cryptocurrencies and the prospect of issuance of stablecoins have prompted for some to call for central banks to issue CBDCs as a precautionary or a defensive measure. There are two major concerns here. First is that widespread substitution away from the domestic currency could threaten a country's monetary sovereignty. In principle, this could result from a shift to a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or a stablecoin denominated in some other currency. It could also result from more standard forms of dollarization and the use of another sovereign currency in either traditional or CBDC form. The argument is that providing households and businesses with access to a digital form of the domestic currency, it may be possible to reduce the likelihood of a shift to other forms of money. Now, a second concern where technology companies are involved is that such companies may have very large user bases, perhaps via their social media services, and they could encourage rapid adoption of stablecoins. It's argued that central banks should provide CBDCs so that individuals have the option of using an alternative electronic form of money with greater privacy around any collection and usage of their payments data. However, it might be that concerns about loss of monetary sovereignty are overstated and that concerns about data privacy can be addressed in other ways. Traditionally, concerns about dollarization and loss of monetary sovereignty have been confined to failed states or economies with histories of inflation or confiscation of financial assets. In countries with well-functioning financial and payment systems and a history of low inflation, like Australia, the risk of widespread adoption of money denominated in some other currency seems very low. I would also note that significant adoption of a stable coin that was denominated in the domestic currency doesn't necessarily raise any concerns regarding monetary sovereignty. Furthermore, if a stable coin denominated in Australian dollars was marketed in Australia, it is likely it would be subject to significant regulation in terms of safety and soundness, potentially involved, including a requirement that it was fully backed by government securities or other very highly rated Australian dollar denominated assets. Similarly, any stable coins that were marketed in Australia would be subject to any required standards regarding privacy, as well as in other areas such as data usage, competition, KYC, and screening for AML and CTF purposes. So let me begin to wrap up. The Reserve Bank and our Payment System Board have been closely watching developments in this broad area for a number of years. Reserve Bank staff are in regular contact with our counterparts in other central banks and also with private sector entities that have an interest in CBDC. Based on the considerations I've summarised today, the bank's view is that there's no strong public policy case has yet emerged for the introduction of a CBDC for general use. Australian households and businesses have access to payment services that have been upgraded significantly in recent years and meet most of their current needs. It's just not obvious that a CBDC would be a solution to any particular problems or that there would currently be any significant demand for one. However, the bank has got an open mind here and will continue to monitor developments in this area. Globally, I'd note there are about 180 sovereign currencies. If some jurisdictions do move towards full implementations of CBDC, there'll be many central banks like us who'll be closely watching their experience. If it turns out there are significant benefits, we'll be able to be fast followers, avoiding any early missteps and taking full advantage of the inevitable technology learnings. In the meantime, separate to our work monitoring the case for a retail CBDC, we are conducting research on the technology and the policy implications for a potential wholesale CBDC. This work is taking place in the Reserve Bank's in-house innovation lab. Some earlier work included the development of a limited proof of concept of an interbank payment system that was DLT-based and used a tokenized form of CBDC that was backed by ESA balances. Currently, the bank is collaborating with a number of external parties on a project to extend this proof of concept to incorporate some tokenized financial assets. This project will explore the implications of delivery versus payment settlement on a distributed ledger platform, as well as some other programmability features of tokenized CBDC and financial assets. This is obviously very interesting research, and we'll be providing further information on it in due course. So Dirk, thank you very much again for the opportunity to speak at this conference, and I'd now be happy to participate in a discussion.
Perfect. Thank you, Tony. This interesting talk. So let's have a discussion. Our panelists, our speakers can come in if they want to ask a question, and the Q&A panel should also be open. No question yet. So stablecoins, so maybe I ask a question quickly. Stablecoins seem to be, there's one question here. Does it mean that central banks are still hesitating to issue cryptocurrency?
Well, the fact is that none of the leading central banks have yet announced a decision to implement a CBDC. The one large central bank that's closest to it is China, and they've got some pilots or prototypes going, and there's every reason to think they will move towards issuance. But amongst the countries that we interact with, the other industrial countries, I think we're all carefully studying it, but none of us have taken a decision to issue central bank digital currencies. But I note the question was about cryptocurrency. And if we define cryptocurrency in the terms that most people do, there's absolutely no interest in central banks. It wouldn't make sense for a central bank to issue a currency that wasn't a liability of the central bank.
Then another question, is there any risk to the global system should China have the first mover advantage in issuing digital currency?
I don't think so. A central bank digital currency that China might issue would be presumably for domestic use. I can't imagine it would be for widespread international use. A general purpose CBDC. If the PBOC does move ahead with issuance, we'll be very interested to see how it goes. I think there are a lot of central banks watching the experience of the early movers here, but I don't think there's any particular reason to think that issuance of a digital form of the RMB raises any concerns here for other central banks.
David Chiang has a question. Will CBDC, if issued, compete with e-money provided by the private sector wallet providers?
Yes, it would. And it would also compete with commercial bank money, with commercial bank deposits. E-money is something that has thrived in some markets, but there are other markets where there's been very little issuance of e-money. The question is, in many markets where e-money hasn't thrived and households still hold most of their money, most of their deposits in commercial banks, what would be the incentive for them to move to move significant parts of their financial claims to a central bank digital currency? We're not convinced that there would be a significant demand for a CBDC, given that in Australia, households have got access to high quality electronic payment services attached to their bank deposits. Their deposits, at least until recently, have yielded a healthy rate of interest, and they have debit and credit cards associated with them. In Australia, we have retail, real real-time retail payments. That is, I could go under my online banking app and I could send Derek some money and he would see it in his account and have access to it in about 2 seconds. So I think the question is, what extra functionality would a CBDC offer that's not available from services offered by the by commercial banks or in some cases by e-money? And it remains to be seen if there would be demand for it.
There's a question about the, so does Central Bank work with the Australian Accounting Standard Board at this moment in terms of CBDC's influence on the change of accounting standards?
I might pass on that one. I don't think that's why I'm sure we're not working. We're not working with them yet because it's not a relevant consideration. But as I said earlier, the introduction of the CBDC would be it would just be a new form of the existing currency. The existing currency is denominated in the Australian dollar. It's a claim on the Reserve Bank, and it would just be a new form of it. So there's no reason to think that it should have any implications from the accounting side.
It's Raymond Silverosa here. You haven't given much joy to the conspiracy theorists. Are there any elements of this that you think are credible? Is there any chance that the government, well, there is a chance, I guess, but how likely is it that the governments will use this for malign purposes to, say, exert more control over the populace? I'm not a conspiracy theory myself, but, you know, I'd like to hear from an expert. It'd be comforting. Does that make sense, the question?
Yeah, well, I can only speak from the Australian perspective, and I don't think the Reserve Bank has got any interest in getting into retail banking. We're quite happy to have a sort of a two-tier banking system where we provide we provide money to a limited group of entities, and the providing payment services and deposit services to households is the responsibility of the private sector, be it commercial banks or be it e-money providers or potentially some new form of entity. But I know the Reserve Bank has got zero appetite for getting into that business, and I can't imagine that too many people in Canberra have got an appetite for it either.
I think it's a very interesting perspective because banks are, like our commercial banks are doing a good job, yes, but there have also been problems, right, highlighted by the Royal Commission, and there is anti-money laundering or money laundering scandals in the retail banking sector, and there's maybe there's also other issues, I guess, but we just had some scandals recently. So that I think it's interesting that you're saying that you have no interest to go into this. Yes, okay, but so you think you couldn't do a better job, or banks couldn't do a better job, or central banks couldn't do a better job in general?
Well, the public sector has an interest in many things. We've got an interest in car safety. You know, we want the population to have safe cars, but that doesn't mean that that the public sector gets into manufacturing cars. Instead, it sets safety standards, and then holds the private sector to high safety standards. And I think the same analogy is relevant in the case of payment services and financial services. The where there are policy concerns, I think there's a few steps. The first one is you encourage the private sector to overcome them. So, for example, the lack of fast payments in Australia, our first reaction was to go to the private sector and say, we think you should build a fast payments system to provide better payment service to households, and we were successful in doing that. The private sector came to the party there, and we now have the new payments platform, which is I'd say we're leading in many respects. I guess the second position would be, if the private sector is not doing what you want to address a particular policy concern, then regulation is the next step. And in Australia, we have quite strong regulatory powers in the payment system. It's a bit different to some other countries where they may not have as strong powers. So regulation is a response for dealing with competition, concerns about competition or efficiency or risk. And public sector provision, I'd say, would be the last resort.
Thank you, Tony. Any other questions from our panel?
Well, perhaps just this, Martin Fenor, just to follow up on the point that Raymond was making earlier, in terms of the privacy concerns about the extent to which citizens have privacy in payments with respect to the government. I think the flip side of the same coin is if you don't have privacy, is that perhaps you don't have privacy in payments with respect to the private sector? For example, credit card companies, debit card companies, your banks, they observe your data. And with the progress that's being made in terms of machine learning, being able to use large data sets for all kind of purposes, you may be wondering, on the one end, perhaps in some situations, it might not be so bad to give up some privacy with respect to the government in exchange for having more privacy with respect to the private sector. Of course, ideally, I think you want to create a system where on the one end, there are safeguards for example, for money laundering to prevent that and other kind of criminal activities. But on the other end, you also want to create a system where basically you have the advantages of privacy and there are very legitimate reasons why you would want to have privacy in your economic interactions. If you just think about the extent to which you can use payments data to predict, for example, the prices that people are willing to pay for products and the extent to which that could potentially facilitate price discrimination. But there's a whole host of legitimate reasons why you want to have privacy in payments to a certain extent. So I think basically there are two sides here of the coin. There's privacy with respect to the government, but there's also privacy with respect to the private sector and the benefits of both.
I'll take that mostly as a comment, and privacy is a hot button topic, so I don't want to weigh in here too much, but I would say that my payments, my payments that I conduct with my bank are actually subject, I think, to a high degree of privacy. I'm the only person that can see my bank statement, unless I happen to have given my login details to somebody else. What I suppose is not private is people can see that if I use a browser or a tech company might see my browsing history, but so I think actually payments themselves are a bit more private than many people think. But it's just that there are so many other aspects of our life, the browsing that precedes the purchase, for example, where we have, for better or worse, chosen to share that data with another entity. But I think the banks do a pretty good job at keeping our payments data private, and there would be, I think, significant consequences for them if they didn't.
If I just may respond to that, Tony, for a moment. So I cannot, obviously, I cannot speak for the payment system in the for payments privacy in the Australian banking system. So kind of to the extent to which you have privacy in payments with respect to the commercial sector is very contextual. But if you just look, for example, at patents and patents applications from, say, Visa, American Express, and MasterCard, they are all applying for patents and have obtained patents for using payments data to actually make predictions of people's behavior based on their payments data. And they have obtained patents for different methods to basically monetize the data. So even though we might have had payments privacy and a high extent of payments privacy so far. Perhaps that's going to change in the future. Of course, nobody can say exactly what's going to happen in the future.
We cannot predict the future. Huh? What I can do now is to close this session, this first keynote session. Tony, thank you very much for this very interesting and inspiring talk and providing a perspective that I didn't expect, but I like unexpected stuff very much. So thanks again for your time. I know that you're very busy. Have a good day, Tony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dirk, and thank you for the invitation to the conference.